Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hey, welcome back to the Pod Crashed. This week, we're telling the story of United Airlines Flight 232. Thanks for listening.
Oh, hello, Mariah.
Hi, Casey.
I am finally going to do the story that it feels so weird to say my favorite story, but because that's doesn't seem like the right thing, but the story, like this is the story that I would like when I was working, you know, at the airport, I would load the Wikipedia page for this story so that I could read it obsessively on the plane.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So we're doing United 232. And we're going back to July 19th, 1989. Brian is a little fetus in his mother's womb.
Yeah.
Like, isn't that nice to think about?
So this is one that probably a lot of people will know, do you think? Or
yeah, we've gotten requests for this one quite a bit. Actually, Sweet Seth requested this one.
Oh, got you. Okay.
2 years ago, probably.
Two yeah.
Like, infinitely long ago.
Yeah.
So, we're finally doing it. So we're going to fly on this hot July day from Stapleton Airport in Denver. That's the old airport in Denver to Chicago O'Hare, the big one in Chicago, and then onward to Philadelphia. And we are flying in a DC-10, which is that's the plane that we use in our logo. It's got the three engines. They're super like powerful planes. They've got the three engines. And we have talked about them before because they initially had some problems with their cargo door.
Right.
If you remember talking about that. Yeah. But it's 1989 and they've worked out the issues with the cargo door. So it's just a big, beautiful, beautiful plane.
Yeah.
It is very, very full today with 296 souls on board.
Wow.
285 passengers.
Okay.
So it's very, 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 very full. Part of the reason is it's summer, but another reason is because it's a Children's Day promotion that United Airlines is running where children can fly for one penny.
Whoa.
So, yeah. So there's out of those 285 passengers, 54 of them are children. Some of them are unaccompanied minors, kids traveling by themselves. Mm-hmm. Four of them are lap infants, meaning they don't actually have a seat of their own, but they're seated in the lap of the parent that they're traveling with. So, and if you look at the flight map, actually, because I know we would do this when, you know, I was a gate agent, you try, if you can, if you've got room, to seat lap infants next to an empty seat, because it is actually pretty difficult and uncomfortable to fly with a baby in your lap for hours. So, but the flight is so full today, you can see that in a couple places they were able to do that, but it's just a full plane with loads and loads of kiddos on it and, you know, just doing fun summer trips.
Yeah.
The captain of our flight today is Alfred, just goes by Al. He's 57 and he has worked at United Airlines since 1956.
Wow. So a long
1956,
time.
1956. A long time. He got hired by UA and he's stuck with them ever since. Loads and loads of experience. He's very close to having 30,000 hours of flight time.
Jeez.
I mean, he's very, very, very skilled, very experienced pilot. The first officer, Bill, is 48. He's worked for a couple airlines before this. He worked for Pan Am for a while, which is cool. He's worked for United Airlines since 1969, so over 20 years, still a long time. And he's got around 20,000 flight hours, so still very, very experienced.
Yeah.
And it's a DC-10, and it's 1989, so the flight engineer is on board, and his name is Dudley. And I just love Dudley.
Yeah.
Dudley's 51. He's a flight engineer. He's only been with United Airlines for a couple years. He has around 2,000 flight hours. So much, 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 much less experience.
Yeah.
I mean, he's totally competent at his job, right? But a lot less experience. And actually, on the DC-10, on this aircraft, he only has 33 flight hours. So he's learning.
Yeah, he's learning.
He's learning. Listen, Dudley is 51 years old.
Yeah.
And I think that like taking on a new thing in life
is beautiful.
And not, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Good
Love
job.
Dudley. Love Dudley. Him. Love him.
Dudley with a D, not Dougley.
Yes. Not Dougley.
Okay.
Aldi. No Aldi, no G.
Okay.
Dudley.
Beautiful.
Beautiful. We love him.
Yeah. Dougley is like what your grandma calls you. Like,
yeah. Yes, exactly. The weather is gorgeous. It's just a nice, I mean, it's a million degrees, I'm sure. Who knows? It could be literally any temperature in Denver, right? Like
yeah.
It just could be any temperature at any time of year. Maybe it's 90 degrees. Maybe it's 20 degrees. Who knows? Denver has the most insane weather ever. But, it, in fact, is a nice day. And they load everybody up onto this super, super full flight. Again, you've got kids traveling totally by themselves, which is exciting and scary. And, you know, everybody's trying to look out for them.
Yeah.
There's the flight attendants and the gate agents are doing their best to, like, get everybody comfortable and situated. Not that easy because, again, super, super, super full flight. They get everybody on there, shut the door, push back, and they take off around 2 o'clock Central Time. So that's the time zone that they're heading toward. They, even though the flight's not that long, from Denver to Chicago, it's only like less than 3 hours. It's 1989. And so they served lunch, which is very nice.
Yeah.
In order to get everyone lunch, pretty much as soon as they're up in the air at cruising altitude, which for them is 37,000 feet. Basically, as soon as they're up there, they're already serving lunch. And again, I just think about like I was 9 the first time I went on a plane and they gave us, it was before 9/11, and they gave us like the little lunches and it was like the best part.
Yeah.
Yeah.
By far.
So much fun. All the little silverware. It's great.
Mm-hmm.
They are up there at cruising altitude and they're flying over Iowa at this point. And they have served lunch and the flight attendants are going down the aisles, you know, taking, you know, people if they're done with their meals, helping out. Again, they're trying to make all of these kiddos as comfortable as possible, doing all of, you know, those different things. Bam. Suddenly there's an explosion.
Oh, no.
In the rear of the aircraft. It shakes the entire plane. This is just a couple years after Lockerbie and like other bombs placed on planes. The flight attendants hit the deck. They like just hit the ground, hold on tight. The plane shudders. Obviously, people are scared. In the cockpit, the autopilot disengages because something has just happened. Bill grabs the controls. He's the first officer and he was the one, you know, who's on deck for that. He grabs the control column and Captain Al starts to focus on the different light warnings and indications that they're getting. And it looks like all the lights are coming from the tail engine. The tail engine, which is on this plane is called Engine 2, had exploded.
Oh, okay.
So Captain Al starts to pull back on the fuel throttle for the tail engine, but the throttle won't move. It stuck in place, won't move. And Bill has the control column in his hand. The autopilot has disengaged, and he's it's like it weighs hundreds of pounds. Ugh. It is so heavy and sluggish. And they had been in a very, very slight right-hand turn when Engine 2 exploded. The flight engineer, Dudley, he says turn off the valve that allows fuel into the tail engine, right? So you can't pull the throttle back, but turn off the valve that allows the fuel in at all. And Captain Al does that. And for a split second, everything is kind of okay, right? It's kind of okay. This plane can fly with two engines. That's why there's three engines in the first place. It's for the redundancy. But Bill is like pulling on the column, and Bill is like bracing his feet and like realizing more and more that he can't like physically move the control column. And they were in that slight right turn, and that right turn is just continuing and continuing and continuing, and the plane won't respond to Bill trying to level the plane out. And so the left wing is dipping down, 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 more and more. That Bill is pulling on it, and he says like, hey, something is wrong here. Something is wrong. I physically can't do it. He's using all of his strength at this point. He's pulled the control column fully as far back as he physically can, and as far to the opposite side as he physically can, like just using all of his strength and his body, yanking on it. But the plane is not responding, and it keeps banking right. Bill says, like, can I have, like, full left aileron? Nothing. It keeps banking. It keeps banking. The plane is going to flip over. Captain Al takes his control column and has this, he goes to pull it back to see if his will work. And his is heavy, 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 like, pushing, like, through concrete. And both of them get on their respective control columns and are trying, pulling as hard as they physically can with all of their strength, trying to keep the plane from flipping over, and nothing is working. Nothing is working. They're gonna flip over. And now they're in a sharp bank. So in the cabin, all of those passengers are just, they had an explosion, and now they can feel they're sideways. They're going to flip over. And Al just shoves the throttles on the right engine and pulls the left engine back. So he fires up the right engine to full power and pulls the left engine back. And that slowly starts to level the plane. So none of their controls are working. None of their controls are working. Mm-hmm. But they have differential thrust. So increasing the thrust on that right engine and decreasing the thrust on the left engine allows the plane to kind of level out, and at least it doesn't flip right over. Al and Bill start to go through and work on the Engine 2 shutdown checklist to keep it from catching on fire or just to move through. Dudley is studying his panel, trying to do what he can. They're using the differential thrust to kind of keep the plane level, but the plane starts to slowly move into a fugoid state, meaning that because they're not able to control to keep the plane level in flight, because they're only able to use the engines and changing the thrust, using different amounts of thrust on each engine is the only tool they have at this moment, the plane, as it goes slower, it'll the nose will point up just a little bit, and then it'll get too slow and it'll start to come down, the nose will come down, and then it'll gain speed because it's going down, and that'll make the nose go up. And they're starting to go into this up and down rocking motion. And Dudley is studying his panel and he sees it. There are three hydraulic lines on a DC-10. They are completely independent of one another, mm-hmm. for redundancy. Hydraulics control everything on this plane, everything related to the actual control of the aircraft. All of that is controlled by hydraulics. And there are three completely independent, redundant systems so that if, God forbid, something happens to one of them or even two of the hydraulic lines, there's still a third one, and that would allow them to control the plane. All three hydraulic lines are showing empty.
Oh, no.
All three are showing empty. That means zero control of the plane, which is exactly what they're experiencing. And Dudley says, like, all three of the hydraulic lines are empty. All three of them are empty. They think, like, okay, maybe it's like the pumps, maybe something that can't be. It's not possible. It's not possible.
Right.
It's not possible. There's three independent lines. They think maybe, okay, if the pumps, if something like broke the pumps that actually pump the hydraulic fluid, maybe they're broken. And so the things are reading that it's empty and that's why we can't control it. Well, guys, we have our best friend in the entire world, Baby Belly Propelli.
Right.
It's called on the DC-10. It's called the air driven generator. It's same thing. They deploy Baby Belly Propelli. He drops down and nothing, because it's not the pumps. It's not the pumps. The lines actually are empty, and they do not have, they are at 37,000 feet going into an increasingly more extreme fugoid state, going up and down and up and down and up and down with a completely full plane full of children and babies. And they don't have any control beyond the incredibly rudimentary control of trying to like baby the throttles back and forth while they're trying to do a million other things. They have no ailerons, no horizontal stabilizer, no flaps, no slats, no elevators, no nothing. They have nothing.
Oh my God.
Pilots cannot know this, but when there was an explosion in engine 2, and when it exploded, it was an uncontrolled explosion, and it cut through. It just happened to slice through all through hydraulic lines, and they are empty. They are empty. They call United Maintenance on the radio because, like, what do we do? There's no training on this.
Yeah.
Guys, this is 2 years after JAL 123, and I know we haven't talked about that one, and I promise we will, but that is present in the mind of these pilots because that was a similar situation, and you do not want that outcome, and they've never received any training. And when they call United Maintenance and say, hey, like something has happened, we have zero hydraulics, none whatsoever in any of the hydraulic lines. And the maintenance person from their company, who frankly, they've been incredibly, incredibly faithful to, the maintenance person has to listen to them saying this and tell them, like, we have no procedure. There's three redundant lines.
Right.
It just, we didn't think it was possible. And we have never, ever, ever prepared for this possibility. And that's a hard thing to say
yeah.
to the voice on the phone who is in like this horrible circumstance. And it's a very hard thing to hear.
Yeah.
And they, it was just.
Of days of all they, days too. Like, right. Like everybody who is a part of United is waking up knowing what day today is. Like it's an initiative.
Right.
The whole thing.
Right.
We're gonna have a great day. There's gonna be no accidents.
Because so again, JAL 123 was only a couple years ago. So earlier today, a man named Denny Fitch, who is a training pilot for United on the DC-10, needed to go to Chicago, and he was actually going to leave much earlier in the day. But his flight that he was originally going to non-rev on was delayed. And so when he got to the airport for his delayed flight, he saw that this flight, United 232, was also going to Chicago, and it was going to leave like 12 minutes sooner than the flight he had originally been booked on. And Denny goes like, oh, whatever, I'm a non-rev. I'm going to, it's, you know, is it okay, guys? You got room? And I will bet you, truly, from the bottom of my heart, any amount of money in the entire universe that the gate agent he spoke to and asked if they had any spots left on this flight. Okay, I bet you anything that she looked at her map and thought like, ooh, like, you know, we've got all these lap infants and I really want to keep like the seat next to the parents open so they have more space for their kids or whatever. Yeah. And it's only a few minutes difference. Like, can you just go on the later one? I would bet you truly any amount of money that that was something that the gate agent thought about.
Yeah.
And, but whatever the exchange was, the gate agent said, you like, sure, you know, yes, there literally are seats on this plane. Yeah. It's very full. It's full of babies. But like, sure. Yeah. Okay. And had put him on this flight. And Denny is sitting there in his seat. He is a 46-year-old training pilot, specifically on the DC-10. He worked for the Air National Guard before that. He's been with United since 1968. He heard the explosion, just like everyone else, and he feels that fugoid state. He's feeling it happening. He's very sensitized to this stuff. He can probably tell just listening to the different sound on either side of him that they're using differential thrust. As a training pilot, Denny, when JAL 123 had happened, he had actually, by himself, his own volition, he had studied it and he had run simulations on loss of hydraulic power on his aircraft he trains for, the DC-10, in his own home. So this is something he takes all of this in. And in the cockpit, the pilots called the flight attendants like to come and just tell, so they could tell the flight attendants, not over the intercom, obviously, tell them in person something is seriously wrong. Like, please, like, get the cabin ready. And as the flight attendant is like rushing up, Denny kind of like catches her and just says like, hey, I'm a training pilot for the DC-10. I'm happy to help. If the pilots want my help, can you just let them know that I'm here and I'm happy to help them? So the flight attendant goes, yep, and like goes into the cockpit where, again, nobody on this plane thinks everything is fine.
Right.
No, not a single person on this plane is capable of. It's not one of those situations where the passengers might not know anything is wrong. Everyone knows something is wrong. Everyone heard the explosion. Everyone felt the plane almost flip over. And the flight attendant gets up there and explains it to the pilots. And the pilots are like, yes, 100%. Get him in here right now. And so when Denny comes into the cockpit, he sees both of the pilots, this is not normal at all, both of the pilots sitting behind their controls are pulling, physically straining, like their knuckles are white, their arms are like swelling from like the exertion, they're sweating, like their whole bodies are going into pulling back on their controls and trying desperately to get some kind of anything out of their controls. And he comes in and sees that, and Captain Al like says like, take the throttles, like you do the throttles and control them. And so Denny like kneels down and like he has something that the other pilots don't have because he's literally an extra set of hands, and he's able to put one hand on each of the throttles for each of the remaining engines on either side of the aircraft and like make those little micro adjustments. Like he practice in his simulator on his own time, and he's able to not they don't have hydraulics, guys. Like, this isn't going to be a magic fix.
Yeah.
But he's able to slow that fugoids thing, that fugoid state, that fugoid cycle down. So instead of being as extreme and as fast and as nauseating and disorienting, he's able to flatten it out just a little. And he's able to keep the wings a little bit more level.
Ooh.
And so they have four brains in the cockpit now. And they get it. They just like physically muscle the plane into a slightly less grotesque cycle of movement. And Al asks Denny, like, hey, can you go look through the window and see if us pulling with all of our strength on these controls is doing anything? Like, look at the ailerons out the window and tell us if anything is happening. And Denny goes back and looks out the window and nothing. The ailerons are not moving at all. Oh. It's not doing anything. And Denny's on this plane too. And Denny goes back and he says they're not moving. And Bill and Al, who are, again, physically forcing this, they believe him, they acknowledge it, but they don't stop. Like, they keep pulling on the controls at extreme physical cost, just because what if it's doing something? Like, what if it's helping a little bit?
Yeah.
Right? You're so incredibly powerless in this situation, and maybe it's helping a little. And they have Denny get back on the throttles, and the three of them, along with the flight engineer, like, keeping track of all of the data, all of the information that today a computer would do. Like, the four of them are hashing it out. They're talking about it. They're trying to figure this out. They're able to, like, figure out, okay, so they were in a slight right turn when they lost hydraulics, when the explosion happened. And because they were in that slight right turn, if they obviously, they're being able to control slightly the ability of the plane to remain in level flight does not actually give you the ability to go where you want to go. It just keeps you from falling out of the sky. So by testing things, they figure out, okay, if you just, like Denny, like very, very, very slightly adjust, like adjusting the throttles, is able to make, you know, like, okay, we can make big, wide, slow right turns, just like lean a little bit more, let that right side, that right bank happen just a little bit, and you can make big, huge, swirling right turns. They call air traffic control and declare an emergency. The air traffic controller, they are over Iowa. The closest airport is Sioux City Gateway, which is a little regional airport. Just my ignorance about Iowa, I looked it up because I was like, I don't know. I don't know what I thought Sioux City was, but 80,000 people. It's not big. It's 80,000 people. So it's the airport for a city with 80,000 people, right? It's not a big airport. And the air traffic controller, like, snaps into action. Like, you wouldn't believe this air traffic controller calls. This is 89. Like, there's not the same level of, like, systems in place for any of this. Yeah. The air traffic controller obviously alerts the fire and, like, EMS support for the airport, but also calls, like, the hospitals, calls, like, anybody that the air traffic controllers can think of to call, they call. And when those different services get those calls, they make their own calls. So, like, the local hospitals called literally every doctor, like, every doctor, period, every nurse, period. Like, you have, like, you work at the dialysis clinic, come on, like, anybody, all hands on deck. Yeah. All hands on deck. This plane is coming with dozens and dozens of children and families and kids and adults and people, and the air traffic controller gets everything rolling as fast as they can and starts to try to guide this totally crippled plane toward the runway of their little airport, their little baby airport.
Yeah.
The pilots call the flight attendants in again and say, like, we're going to go try to land at Sioux City, prepare the cabin for an emergency landing. And the flight attendants need to, like, convey the instructions for an emergency landing to, again, dozens of children traveling alone, families with kids. Like, obviously, okay, I don't want to overemphasize it, I guess, because I do not have children and I don't want to be in this situation, but just the flight attendants have to like explain these procedures, and they have to explain to the parents who are traveling with babies in their laps. They have to explain to them that the procedure is to lay, like you have to brace yourself, right? So you have to like brace position on a plane is to like lean forward, lay your belly on the tops of your thighs and like hold your ankles, mm-hmm. head down. If you're traveling with a baby under two in your arms, then you need to lay the baby down on their back and like hold them, like press their little body into the floor and brace yourself. And I just think about like, I mean, think about how hard it is to put a baby in a crib by themselves.
Right.
And like, just like, so the flight attendants are getting the cabin ready. The procedures, having to explain, and they keep trying to keep everybody calm. They keep trying to say, like, we're just going to make an emergency landing. You know, we're not that far from the airport. Like, you know, trying to be as reassuring as possible. But the passengers know. They know. Of course they know. In the cockpit, I know it's hard to get a sense of time passing in these stories, but we are like 30 minutes into this, 30 minutes into the nauseating fugoid cycle, like 30 minutes into the physical, the extreme physical exertion that Al and Bill are placing on their bodies by like pulling the columns, literally trying to force the pieces of a plane outside to move. That's what they're doing.
Like they're trying to be Superman.
With working together and trying to like do it together, but truly like pulling for their lives.
Yeah.
And they're communicating with air traffic control, like Denny is down there, like just trying to make those tiny little adjustments, making those big looping right turns, trying to get lined up with the runway, and talking to air traffic control at some point in just the pretty standard professional communication. The captain just spits out to the air traffic controller, like, whatever you do, just keep us away from the city. And the air traffic controller agrees, and Denny says, like, trying to, like, light, I don't know, again, people just deal with stressful situations in different ways. And Denny says, like, I'll tell you what, like, we'll have a beer when this is all done. And Al is like, well, I don't drink, but I will, will have a beer with you. Yep, yes. Like, yeah. They are getting closer, and as they like come around, they're trying to get lined up. So the air traffic controller, again, who is trying so hard and has like gathered a huge like army of fire engines, of EMTs, ambulances, just this like army of them. There are kind of two runways at this airport. They numbered them 22 and 31. 31 is the actual runway that's in use currently, and it's 9,000 feet long. So it's like it got given them lots of space to slow down. And so runway 22, the other runway is decommissioned. Like it hasn't actually been in use for a while. And that's where the air traffic controller has the rescue crews like waiting.
Mm-hmm.
And as they like make their turn in the plane coming around, trying to get lined up with runway 31, they're lined up with 22. They're lined up with 22.
Oh,
and
Jesus.
This is it. That's the runway we got to be on.
Yeah.
And they tell the air traffic controller, and the air traffic controller just says like, yep, you got it, champ.
Yeah.
And like calls the crews and tells them like, they're coming your way. So like, get out of the way, but don't go anywhere because we need you. And they get lined up as best they can. And they start to look at just at the numbers in this situation. And they are going, So for this aircraft, for this DC-10, a safe landing speed is 160 miles per hour. And the sink rate, so meaning how fast they're going down, is 300 feet per minute. That's what you want your landing to be like. They are going 250 miles an hour, and they are sinking at 1,850 feet per minute. So they know, and there's nothing they can do. Yeah. They don't have flaps. They don't have anything. So like they know that they're going to slam into this runway if they make it.
Yeah.
And the air traffic controller calls them and is like, hey, like I closed down the interstate for you so you can land on the interstate if you think that would be easier to line up with. And like, because the air traffic controller is doing everything they can. And they're like, no thanks. Like runway's good. Like we got it. Like we're lined up with 22. And they have to decide now, like, okay, so if they drop the landing gear, it's going to change the flight dynamics. It's going to change the way that the plane like just maneuvers. And they have very poor control already. Very poor control. And if they drop the gear, it's going to make it, it's just not predictable. They just don't know how it's going to change. And they already have so little control of this plane. And they are talking about it. But if they don't drop the gear, again, they're supposed to have a sink rate of 300 feet per minute. They are darn close to 2,000 feet per minute. They need that like buffer. They need the shock absorption of the gear. They need it. And they agree, going to drop the gear. But again, four brains in the cockpit, right? Twice as many as most pilots have today, right? So four people talking, they're like, wait, two, another thing. The gear, right, is only down during like landing and takeoff, right? Shortly after takeoff, right? So it's the gear is connected to the systems that are only used at very, very, very slow speeds comparatively to the rest of flight, right? So maybe the gear, right, is connected to the outboard ailerons, meaning like the ailerons like furthest from the center of the plane.
Mm-hmm.
Those maybe when we drop the gear, maybe that will release a little bit of hydraulic fluid and maybe we'll get a little bit of control in those ailerons, like at that moment.
Yeah.
That might help us. And so they are hoping, right? And they drop the gear again, no hydraulics. So they have to use like the weird little way of dropping the gear. But, you know, thankfully somebody thought of that a long time ago, and they're able to drop it without the use of hydraulics. And they are waiting to see if they're going to have a little bit of control of their ailerons, and they drop the gear and it clicks into place because of gravity, and nothing. It didn't release any hydraulic fluid. So now the gear is down and it does change the dynamics of how they're flying, and they're able to like manhandle it back into something kind of like level flight, and they're lined up and they're not going to be able to slow down, and they're not going to get it's happening. And they call the flight attendants and call over the intercom that like, we're bracing, like we're here, this is happening. And the flight attendants have to like get locked in and have to like, you know, buckle up themselves, and they have to tell like the kids by themselves to brace, and they have to tell the parents traveling with their little babies. And again, I think about like whenever I picture this in my mind, I always used to picture like a baby, like a 3 month old baby.
Mm-hmm.
But I was thinking about it. It's any kid under two. So, I mean, I think about like an 18 month old, like a toddler, and just having to like, instead of holding them, which is what I'm sure you'd want to do, you have to like push them into the floor and look at them, like look in their little face and just like press their little body into the floor. And they're coming in and they're as lined up as they're going to get, and they're as slow as they're going to get, and they've got as much control as they're going to get. And right before they touch down, the plane starts to roll and the nose starts to dip. Mm. And Denny shoves both of the throttles forward, just shoves them both forward to get more lift so that the nose will pick up. And Dudley, the flight engineer, says, like, stop, close them off. Meaning, like, turn off, don't do that. And Elle says, turn left, don't close off the engines. And Denny says, like, no, I can't pull them off or I will lose it. Like, that's what's turning us. And Dudley says, okay. And Denny says, come on. Just they're trying to figure out. Al says, like, left throttle, left, because right wing is about to hit. And Al just, they're going so fast that the, like, whoop, whoop, pull up thing is screaming at them and they're trying to yell over it. And Al screams, like, everyone stay in brace. And the right wing hit the runway. They had dumped fuel, but they couldn't dump all of it because their only form of control is the engines. And when the right wing hit the runway, fuel poured out of it and immediately ignited. The tail hit next and just snapped off. The rest of the plane slammed down onto the landing gear and bounced and slammed down and bounced and slammed down, and the landing gear snapped off. The right wing ripped off. The plane cartwheeled down the runway and shattered into many pieces.
Oh, no.
And the rescue crews, like, swarmed the area, just poured off out of the other runway onto their runway and started to break off into different parts, trying to go to the different pieces of the plane. In a few places, people actually, like, walked out of their section of the plane.
Whoa.
And they could see the cockpit area, the part of the plane included the cockpit, was crushed. And again, in these moments, like, in these situations, you just have to, like, make a decision and go with it. And it was crushed and they just went for other parts of the plane. And again, there's you can hear kids screaming, you can hear babies crying, you can hear parents trying to find their children. Like, they tried to put the fire out as fast as they could. There are passengers who walked off the plane and ran back in to try to get kids or family members. One of the mothers who had pressed her baby down into the floor as soon as the impact happened, her baby had shot, her little daughter had shot out of her hands, and she couldn't find her baby. And somebody else had picked up the baby and ran out with her, and she found her. So there's people finding their children.
Jesus.
The one mother, there's not details about this, but one mother confronted is the word that I've seen used.
Mm.
Jan, one of the flight attendants on the tarmac, because her son, who she had pressed into the floor, had died.
Mm.
And she confronted the flight attendant who had told her to lay her baby down on the runway. And after about 35 minutes, they made it to the part of the plane that had the cockpit crushed, and they started to break into it. And inside, all four of the pilots in the cockpit were alive. All four of them were alive.
Oh my God.
296 people were on that plane. And 112 of them died.
Oh.
And 184 lived.
Holy cow.
There were 52 children on board, including 4 lap infants. One of the lap infants, little Evan, died, and 11 other children died. 43 survived. Sioux City as a city was so completely devoted to helping people as much as they could.
Yeah.
They like lines around the block to donate blood. There were 2 doctors for every patient at some points.
Wow.
Because doctors, every kind of doctor from all over, I mean, from hours away came. There's like one little college there, and the college kids like opened up the dorm to people traveling and like traveling in from out of town, or like from doctors traveling in from out of town, for people coming to visit their families, for whatever. And ...184 people live.
Honestly, I truly did not think a single person was going to be able to survive that.
It's unfathomable. Like, it's horrible, 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 horrible. But it is so... It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
That more than half of the people lived. And... I always feel like it, I don't know why with this story, I always feel like not that interested in the investigation. I don't know why, but it, so when the NTSB arrived, they knew because they had survivors, because they had people to talk to, because they had all 4 pilots at all, right? Which that's more than they planned for the flight, right? With Denny's help, they knew right away that the problem had been in that engine 2, in the tail engine.
Yeah.
And so they want to reconstruct the tail engine. They want to see, you know, put the pieces together. And when they were trying to, like, put the pieces back together, they realized that a fan disc, just a fan inside the engine, was missing. They didn't have it at all. And they searched the Air National Guard for Iowa, came out and, like, searched everywhere. And they just, like, could not find that fan disc, which made them think it's probably something with the fan disc. Mm-hmm. And again, this was in late July. And in October, 3 months after this flight, when it's time to start harvesting corn, a corn farmer, she was harvesting her field and came across the fan disc and knew right away what it was.
Holy cow.
And she knew what it was, and she called them, and actually they had put out a reward of $50,000 for finding the fan disc. And she got it. Yeah, good. Absolutely good. But she actually like donated a lot of the money, which I was kind of like, I mean, good for her.
Yeah, yeah.
But like also like if she had just kept it, I would have been totally
fine. Yeah.
Like, yeah. Like, thank you, right, ma'am. Thank you. So they got the fan disc, and it in fact was the fan disc. Basically what it, there was a fatigue fracture just from use. There was a fatigue fracture on the fan disc, and while they were flying, it had broken And when it broke, it was uncontained and it exploded. And when it exploded, right at that point, it's just one of a couple points in the DC-10 where all three of the hydraulic lines are close to one another. Mm. Because, I mean, you think about a plane up by the tail, everything's closer, right, to everything because it's just a narrower part of the aircraft. And it had just hit just right to slash through all three of the hydraulic lines.
Oh my God.
They United, the NTSB, the FAA, like the Airline Pilots Association, like multiple different groups tried to like run this flight in simulations to see if they could create a protocol for this situation. And they just can't.
Wow.
They just can't.
Yeah.
Have Denny on your plane, have an extra person there to help. Like there's just, they need to change. And I'll say this. So that engine had actually been inspected a few months earlier, and the NTSB did think that the fatigue fracture was probably visible at that time, but they actually said that like they didn't, I guess they felt like United's process was rigorous enough, but they just didn't account for human factors enough, like just the fact that people miss stuff. And what they ultimately ended up doing was just changing the design of the DC-10 to put like stops valves in the hydraulic lines. So even though there's three redundant lines, if they get slashed, if any of them get slashed, having like a stop gap along the lines, you know what I'm saying, if that makes sense,
yeah.
Places along the line where it will seal off so that if any of them, not even just if all three of them, but if any of them get like leak in them for whatever reason, it will like close off so you won't lose all of the hydraulic control. Because any hydraulic control would have made a major difference here, right? But yeah.
Wow.
That is
a lot. Is the protocol for crash landing for lab kids, is that still to put them on the floor? Do you know?
I've tried to see. And the thing is, so Jan, that flight attendant, she actually spent like the next, as far as I know, she's still crusading for this, that she feels like it's just too dangerous to have lap infants as a concept at all.
Right.
Like, it's just why do we allow this? And I mean, we live in the future, so we know that that's still how it is. And I don't know. I don't even, I feel like on one hand, like I get it because being able to have a lap infant, there's just people who just will not be able to afford to fly if they have to pay for a ticket for their baby, right? And then there's also, being able to afford to fly, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think it's at a point where, and this is a larger conversation too, but I think there's a lot of systems, like a lot of societal systems or like norms, you know, like flying.
Right.
That are constantly obviously being improved upon as much as they can. And I do think that a lot of these systems just need a complete overhaul to catch up with modern day, you know, like I just think there's a lot of systems that just need a exactly what what was the flight attendant's name?
Oh, Jan.
Yeah, like what Jan's saying is like that concept in and of itself, you know, maybe we need to reimagine the inside of a plane, or, and I'm sure they're doing this all the time, like I don't, you know, obviously I don't know the ins and outs of airplane design, but it just seems like, I don't know, there needs to be a little bit more ingenuity there in terms of,
I mean,
like,
it seems like even if,
yeah,
right, like even if you made something like those, like if you're in a skiing accident or something, God forbid, like those like stretchers that they put you on, yeah, that they like wrap you up onto it.
Yep.
It seems like even something like that, that you could like affix to the floor.
Right.
That would, so it's not your own hands, which I mean, that all, I don't know. I think about that a lot because I just think about like how, while you're waiting for the impact, right? Like right, not knowing how hard to like press,
yep,
like your baby into the floor. And again, if they're 19 months old and they're like, they're hating it, right? And squirming and scared,
I'm
and
screaming,
like, I can't,
yeah,
screaming and like just the fear and like every human instinct you have to like hold your baby tight.
Yep.
And like, but I also think about the like when the impact happens, if you like, you just don't have the human ability to like get the amount of force just right, but when the impact happens, you're going to be tossed yourself,
right?
And just, I just can't, it's unimaginable, it is like an unfathomable like experience,
yeah,
that just no one should ever have to experience. And if there was something, yeah, that you could like strap the baby in and like at least something besides your hands keeping your baby in one spot,
yeah,
I don't know. But
and I think like it's such, I mean, a sudden, yeah, like, yeah, especially with flying, like you never expect a crash, of course. And I think it's always on everybody's mind, obviously, because it's a possibility, but because it is generally so safe, it is,
right,
it's such like a shocking thing to have to do in the moment and then to have to act quickly. And then, you know, and your body is like under this incredible stress for what was it, 30 minutes before they were able to.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, how long were they actually in the air?
45 minutes.
Yeah.
Like, 45
that's
minutes.
Insane. That's an insane amount of time.
Oh.
And then for it to end with you having to put your kid on the floor, like, I just can't,
right,
imagine. You
it's
know?
Just so horrible. And just like, oh my gosh, if you would like put your kid on like the plane to go visit their like aunt,
right,
in Philadelphia, like by themselves, and you heard about this, just, or if, I mean, I don't know. I don't know if it's just because of like my age, but I just think like being a child and being in that situation,
yeah,
is so scary.
Right.
It's horrible.
Yeah.
It's horrible. It's horrible. And it is like it is incredible that all four pilots survived, but it's incredible that thanks to them, anyone survived.
Truly. I thought, I know that when you were halfway through this flight, I was like, I was like preparing myself for all the pilots to, you know, because that's just kind of what normally happens, like,
right,
for the flight pilots to die.
In
the,
a,
like,
in a,
yeah,
plane like this.
Especially with coming in so fast and, you know,
oh,
where they're positioned,
gosh,
and all of that. Like, it's,
yeah,
insane that they survived. Did they continue flying? Do you know?
I am so glad that you reminded me to say so, because all four of them went back to work,
oh,
and,
my,
like, continued to fly.
Well.
All four of them. Madness.
That, I don't know what to tell you.
I mean, great. I mean, in
good
a good
job,
way.
Good job, right.
Not trying,
like,
to say,
yes.
Yeah. Like, holy
amazing
cow. Yeah.
That's that.
Imagine
that
being
Cold War.
Yeah. 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 Right. July 89.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a crazy time for the world.
Right.
So.
God.
Oh my gosh. But yeah. That's.
I couldn't. I don't know if I'd. Not after that.
I mean.
Even like, I know that, you know, like, generally corporations and CEOs and billionaires are on our shit list, but like I would imagine, you know, I don't know, just like when I have a big day at work or there's something like exciting happening, like you wake up and you think about it and you're like, okay, this is gonna be a great day, you know, like it's a different day than normal. And having kids basically fly free seems like such like a generous and like helpful and like nice thing to do, you know?
Right. In the summer. It's
like,
not like it's not even hard to sell tickets in the summer. Right. It seems like a genuinely nice thing.
Yeah. And then like then this happens. It's like the literally the worst case scenario. Just horrible. Yeah.
Horrible. Oh my gosh. And then again, I just think about like if maybe it's just again because it's a job I've had, but I think about the like gate agent for this flight when it was leaving, and like when you hear when you finally like learn that Denny, like because you would probably think like, oh my gosh, I like moved that non-rev to this flight,
right,
and he's probably gonna die because, you know, I didn't just tell him, you know, like, no, wait 9 minutes for the other flight or whatever, you know. And then finding out that his presence contributed tremendously to anyone survive, like, I don't
seriously,
know that
right, just like all of the different people involved in the immediate situation and like the ripple effects, you know, like obviously that's why we talk about things is because of their ripple effects, but
right,
it's always amazing to me how many different perspectives there are. And you know, because even like air traffic control, I mean, they did everything they could to help them land safely, you know, and at some point it's out of everybody's control and it's just like, let's hope it goes well.
Right. The air traffic controller, just like, I think about like, I know I've talked about this before, but you know, my own dear mother, like her is a nurse and she just can't believe that none of her kids became nurses because it's just obviously the best job.
Right.
But I think about like part of that is feeling like you like being able to handle an emergency situation is at least for me, I'll say like I can handle things a lot better if I feel like I actually have something to offer, like I can help.
Totally.
And I think about for an air traffic controller, how often they're powerless. Mm-hmm. Like there's just there just isn't anything they can do.
Right.
And then in this case, like the air traffic controller did everything that they could do.
Yep.
And like all of those, I just think about like other stories we've done where like they did the same thing where like the hospitals like got all hands on deck, everybody, like you are in bed, you're on vacation, you're whatever, like just, you know, get here as fast as you can. And like flights where people don't survive and there's just nothing, they just have to go home, and how horrible that is.
Right.
And like in this case, just having so much, there were people donated like supplies too, like medical supplies, like hospitals and like whatever, clinics, whatever, donated so many supplies to the area hospitals in Sioux City that they had like 6 months worth of supplies even after everything. And like they didn't, like blood donations, there's, you know, just like you don't know who was in like a motorcycle accident 2 months later and the hospital had enough blood because people showed up to donate for this.
Yeah,
you know?
right No, exactly. Oof.
I know that I overstepped my bounds and requested a specific fact for today.
Yes. Let me pull up some facts for us for today. No, this was, I'm really, really glad that you actually brought this up. Because it's really important. And, you know, I think so the facts today are going to be about blood donation. And I know that like for some people, like my older brother, talking about blood, talking about needles, talking about anything like that will actually make him pass out. So if
this,
I mean, I don't, maybe you're not listening to this podcast if that's like the thing that happens to you, but just be forewarned that this next segment is all about blood. But you and I, Casey, you and I have both been pretty, as much as we can, and tried to be regular blood donors. We just wanted to, I'm glad that you requested talking about this. So we just wanted to share some, blood donation facts and some information on where you can donate blood. Because I think when people think about donating blood, they think about like the Red Cross, or they think about, you know, like events that are being held. Sure. And I think not a lot of people realize that you can be a regular blood donor, like have a schedule where you're going, you know, a certain amount of times per year. And that in terms of where you can donate, obviously you can Google anything that's around you. But the main places that you can donate are just your doctor's office, hospitals. There's a lot of areas in probably in your neighborhood where you wouldn't think that you could donate blood. So truly, like, just a simple Google search about like where can I donate blood near me will pull up generally a list of probably 100 places you could go. Because it is such a need, especially, I mean, these are facts obviously related to the United States. I'm not exactly sure what other places are looking like, but it is an insane need in the United States. And I would imagine everywhere around the world. But generally, I just wanted to give some requirements for donating blood. So the like bare basics before you go donate, if you've received any vaccines or anything like that, you should wait a couple of days before you go. Your local places may have specifics on, you know, the type of vaccine, like if you get the COVID vaccine or something else, there may be a specific wait period that you have. So if you've just received vaccines, you should probably wait. You have to, in a lot of places, you have to be at least 16 years old with a parental consent, and you have to be a certain weight. This varies, obviously, depending on what you're donating. But generally, the weight, you have to be at least 110 pounds is what I was seeing, but
I was gonna say I think it's 100. That's what I've heard.
Yeah, 110, right? Because like there's a lot of different
states.
Yeah, there's, and it depends on your state and like your height and all of that stuff. But generally,
right?
No, say that again.
Right. Oh, I was just, there's also there's different. Maybe I hope I'm not stealing this from you.
No,
like,
please.
There's different things you can donate. So there's like whole blood, which is just a straight. Yeah.
Yep.
And then there's like, I know that in order to donate what they call, at least in around here, like double red, where they give you back all of your platelets, but they keep like 2 pints of blood or whatever it is. They, you have to be 160 pounds to donate that.
Right. Right. Right.
And I know,
and
I know that because it's been my mission to, I'll leave it alone. I've been trying to donate double red for years. And every time they're like, no,
you don't weigh enough.
And I'm like, but you don't know that. Right. You're not weighing me. Take my blood. Like,
prove it. Like,
Don't
bring out a scale.
My mom hates that.
No, yeah.
My mother, the nurse, does not like that I've been trying to, whatever.
Yeah.
Go on, I'm interrupting you.
Yes, no, you're fine. And then, so those are like just kind of the general, you have to be feeling well, make sure you're not sick. And then obviously you want to bring some sort of photo ID that day.
And stuff like... piercings and tattoos.
Yes,
generally,
yes.
There's like a waiting period after.
Exactly. So
piercings and tattoos.
Yeah, there's generally like some medication restrictions as well. So you'll want to, if you are on medications, take a look at the list. Again, all of this is available via Google. Tattoos and piercings used to be, I think that's like a misconception these days, because I remember when I was in high school, we would give blood regularly at, they would come to our school, and it was a huge thing, like if anybody had gotten a piercing or a tattoo recently. But from the guidance that I've seen, it's actually okay as long as you wait 3 months, which that's, yeah, I think, the general rule now, which when I was young, when we were younger, it was you had to wait at least a year. At least that's what I was told.
Yeah.
And maybe that's a New York State thing. I'm not really sure, but it seems that it's shortened now, which is nice.
I have no tattoos, so I did not pay that close. And my only piercing were my ears when I was 20. So I don't, I'm not up to date on the requirements around that.
Yeah.
But if it is, 3 months would make sense because they test all of the blood anyway, you know, but they don't want to take your blood if you have,
it's a waste of resources. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like you were talking about, there's a bunch of different types of blood that you can give. So you can give whole blood, like Casey was saying, which is just like the regular, you know, you go in and you sit for 15 minutes, they take your blood. You can give platelets, which are like the small little disc shaped cells, that helped with like, what's it called? Like, clotting.
Clotting.
So you can donate those. Plasma, you can also donate double red cells. There is, I wasn't sure if I wanted to mention this. I guess it's important. I don't know. You can donate blood back to yourself if you're having like some sort of elective surgery done.
Oh, yeah.
Which is nice. Like, you know, you can, so you're not taking other people's blood. That's like a good thing to do. And then you can also donate your blood like directly to someone, like if, you know, if it's a match, obviously, and everything works out. There are a bunch of different blood types. I'm sure most of you know. Interesting though is that type O in the United States, 37% of the population has type O. And the next highest is type A, which
O negative is like
O negative is 6%, and then AB negative is 1%. And what was the thing about AB negative? So AB blood is AB. Okay, wait, how do I want to say this? So O negative, everybody can receive. Right, like anybody who has any type of blood,
O negative, anyone can receive.
Yeah, they can receive.
O neg.
Yeah.
No, sorry. So O neg. So I'm O neg, which means that they call me. They don't let me forget.
Yes.
to
yes.
donate blood. But so O neg, anybody can have my blood.
Yes, and you can
and
only
AB
have
AB positive. I can only have
O neg. Yeah, and AB positive, everyone can give to AB positive, but
yes,
they can only donate.
They can only give to themselves, basically.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. They can only receive their, and if you don't know your blood type, they tell you. That's nice.
Yeah, that is very cool.
Yeah.
But I thought that was interesting. Like, I didn't realize the distinction there between platelets and whole blood. Like, I thought it was O negative across the board, but I guess it's AB and AB negative for platelets and plasma. That everybody can receive, but O negative for whole blood. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. It's a huge, depending on your blood type, right? I mean, no matter what blood type you have, it's like an amazing thing to be able to offer.
Yeah.
And it does literally save lives. And the thing is, like, you're pretty disconnected from that, because you don't see the person, you're not aware of them. But like, another thing that's tough is that when people do like 9/11, Boston Marathon, like bombing, like these different things where people show up to donate blood en masse, like, which is great and beautiful, excellent, like that is a wonderful thing. But one of the things that can happen is people will like not show up to donate like a month after.
Right.
And it can, you know, it doesn't last forever. So if you can, then getting on like a schedule where you donate every, depending on what kind of blood you're donating, every 10 weeks, every 6 weeks, whatever it is for your, what you're able to donate.
Yeah.
And like, it's just,
I mean, there are so many different reasons that people need blood too. Like, a lot of the stuff that I was reading, it's mostly for cancer treatments, to be honest. Like, people need a lot of blood for specific, like, cancer treatments, chemotherapy, that kind of thing. And there are over 1 million people diagnosed with cancer every year. So, like, we got to be... Oh, right. Also, only 38% of the American population is eligible to give blood.
And I don't want to not say this. So part of the reason for that is because of the, like, some of that is just like age and like weight restrictions and stuff like that. But also, like, they got to update the requirements that were set during the AIDS crisis that like preclude like men who have sex with men or women who have sex with men who have sex with men or anything like that. Like, just they absolutely do have to change that.
Yeah.
Thank God it's been 40 years and we've like made really, really major advances in treating AIDS.
Right.
And we test the blood for it. But
and only 2% of the population actually does donate.
Yeah.
And that's really low considering a lot of people need it.
Right. And in some states, so New York State, one of the law changes that was made around the AIDS crisis was that you can't get paid to donate blood. You can get paid to donate plasma, but you can't be paid to donate blood in New York State. That's not true in other states. You know, there are definitely places across the country and probably across the world where you can get a little money for it, too. And or like gift cards or whatever they offer. And I'll say this, unlike the like ick factor, if you like needles are one of those things that just some people just electing to have electing for blood donation is just not going to be a thing for you. And I don't want to like shame people who feel that way. But if you're on the fence, so if you like don't faint, if you see somebody, you know, if you see blood or like if needles, if the, if you don't have like a really strong physiological reaction to that, maybe just go and like with a friend and like watch them and see how you feel. Right. If you feel woozy, head home, get some ice cream. Like, it's fine.
Yeah.
But if you feel like maybe, you know, maybe sometimes seeing it can give you more data about whether or not you're going to be able to do it. Or if you don't think it would bother you necessarily, but you do think that like the hassle factor is part of it too, right? That's why blood donation drives at like workplaces or schools or colleges. Like, they're so such that it's like the backbone of our blood donation system because it's kind of like a captive audience, right? Like, people, you know, you still decide whether or not you want to donate, but you just go somewhere and it's kind of like an event that's happening that day. And maybe even if you personally, maybe you're not a good fit or maybe you're not eligible for whatever reason, but you can maybe talk to your HR, your school, your college about organizing a blood drive at a location.
Yeah.
And that's even better than individual contribution. So
definitely. It's like it's like a life-saving roller coaster. Like, it can be really scary to do, but you're not gonna die. And people will live because of it.
It is good news. Yeah. I really always want to watch them. Like, I want to watch them, and I've had like multiple phlebotomists be like, please don't watch me.
Can you look away?
This.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you, like, you're freaking me out. I don't know. But yeah. And which I don't blame them. Like, I don't, it doesn't feel comfortable to be watched at work.
Right.
I'm not trying to freak you out.
You know,
I'm
what's
sorry,
actually
man,
funny? I, when I was at the doctor the other day, they drew my blood and it was so good.
Yeah. Good. God bless her. She got it. Yeah.
You're trained for this. Let's go.
Yeah. I'm just going to take a peek.
Right.
Just a little peek.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You teach me.
Oh. Yeah. After this, I know that, so just before we say goodbye, I'm going to record, like, separately from this, a little like something about what's been going on in my life. And so just to let you guys know, I know that obviously most of you click off, I'm sure, right after we're done recording together, but, and you can still do that. I'm not going to, there won't be a test, but just as a heads up, instead of a commercial, it's going to be a little bit more information, I guess. So, yeah, I love you so, so much, Mariah.
I love you, Casey. Thanks for telling that, that story.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being so wonderful.
Love you.
Patient. I love you. See you next week, guys. We love you.
Bye.
And we'll see you soon. Bye. Hey guys, so a few weeks ago, my beautiful, kind, fun, loving, sweet Aunt Mary Beth died unexpectedly. She was a teacher, a wife, a mother, a daughter, a sister, and for me and my husband, she and her husband were beloved aunt and uncle and the people who helped us buy the land that we purchased at the beginning of this year. My Aunt Mary Beth was like the person who struck the, my Aunt Mary Beth struck the balance between doing good and having a good time more than anyone I've ever known. She, so fun loving, so sweet, so compassionate. I feel like the world is less without her. And I feel like, all of our lives are so much more because of her. I love her. And I'm so grateful for her. And I know that some of you listening to this know and love her too. And I love you, and I'm grateful for you. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of The Pod Crashed. We so hope you enjoyed it. If you want to get in touch with us for any reason, you can find us on Instagram and TikTok or email us at thepodcrashed@gmail.com. We are 110% still making this show. It's just a lot's been going on. We truly, truly can't wait to see you guys next week or the week after that. Thanks for listening.